Welcome to this RCGP podcast on the menopause. I'm Dr. Tony Hazel, a GP with an interest in women's health, and today I will be interviewing Dr. Anne Connolly. Anne is a gypsy in gynaecology and the RCGP Women's Health Champion. She's leading on the development of the Women's Health Toolkit, which includes relevant learning materials and resources to help primary care clinicians optimise the care provided, particularly for patients experiencing menstrual concerns. She's also chair of the Primary Care Women's Health Forum, which seeks to share best practice and provide training in women's health issues to those working in primary care. Thank you for joining us today, Anne.
Hello, Tony, and thanks very much for helping me with this podcast.
So let's start with the absolute basics. Can you run through what is happening in a woman's body at the time of the menopause and when it usually happens?
Average age in the UK, just over 51, but obviously there's a range, 45 to 55 is generally the range that will affect women. And what happens to us physiologically is we run out of an egg supply. We are born with our finite number of eggs in the ovaries, and gradually over the years, the egg supply starts to drop off. And by the time we get to the menopause, the eggs are pretty much run out. The problem that then has is on our hormones. So the ovaries are our main supply of estrogen, and as our egg supply runs out, so the estrogen levels start to fall off. And ultimately that's what happens at the menopause, is that before the menopause we have estrogen, and after the menopause we have a much lower amount of estrogen, which causes the longer term problems. But around the time of the perimenopause, our gonadotrophins, which are follicle stimulating and luteinizing hormone made by the anterior pituitary gland, they start to lose their ability to go through their normal changes because the FSH level is having to rise to try and find some of those last eggs to trigger as that supply runs out. So it's hormonal chaos, basically.
I think that's a really good way to describe it, hormonal chaos. And the thing is, isn't it, that that can cause an awful lot of symptoms. So everyone knows about hot flushes and night sweats, but what other symptoms that women may not associate with the menopause might make us think about it?
Yeah, it's a great question because it's one of these typical case books when somebody comes in and says, I've got night sweats and hot flushes and I'm age 51 and my periods have become less frequent. You know, that is really simple, but lots of women will experience a huge variety of symptoms. The British Menopause Society did a survey and they found that 80% of women around the time of the perimenopause, around that age, 51-ish, were experiencing symptoms. 25% said they were severe, 40% said they were worse than anticipated. We also know that the vasomotor symptoms, the flushes and the sweats, they're the classic ones, but we know that that many women will get other symptoms that might include anxiety, palpitations, sleep deprivation causes fatigue, irritability. Lots of women will describe a myalgia, sort of a fibromyalgic type of myalgia. And they're the symptoms that will come around the time of the menopause. A little bit later, we start to get the problems of estrogen deficiency affecting the urogenital tract. And so some women will get that vaginal dryness, some women will get urinary symptoms, maybe stress incontinence, urge incontinence, recurrent UTIs. So different women will get affected in different ways. Periods, some women will get infrequent periods and then they'll get some heavy erratic bleeding. We need to know, do we need to investigate that before we start saying it's menopausal? So it's about, as ever, listening to the woman's story and letting her talk and letting her tell us the points that really matter to her. And then we put the bits of the jigsaw together.
So once we've put those bits of the jigsaw together, how do we actually confirm the diagnosis? I'm aware that not every woman needs a blood test, although people often come in and ask for one. And of course, these days, it is slightly complicated by the fact that women might be on contraception, which causes amenorrhea. So we can't always use the period stopping as a clue to the menopause.
The blood test we would do if we were going to do one is follicle stimulating hormone. And the reason we do that is because that goes up in the perimenopause. It's having to drive the ovaries harder to try and find that follicle to stimulate. So FSH levels go up, and if they stay up, then we can tell someone they're menopausal. But NICE very clearly tell us that we shouldn't necessarily rely on that as a test in women over the age of 45, because if they've got menopausal symptoms, they've got menopausal symptoms, and we should be listening to the story. That's much more important. The problem with FSH is sometimes you can take an FSH level at one time of a cycle in one of the cycles, and it might be falsely low. So then you give the woman really confusing information. So in a woman of perimenopausal average age, somewhere between 45 and 55, it's not worth doing unless you're looking to help her with some other issues, like whether or not she needs to continue to take her contraception. So we know in women who are taking progesterone-only contraception, they might have the implant or the intrauterine system in, we can do blood tests, and that will help us. So if the woman is over 50 and she's using a method of contraception, she's not sure whether she needs to carry on with that, we can do an FSH level. If it is above 30, then we can say she's menopausal on that day, but she needs to use extra precautions or contraception for at least 1 year, because then we can guarantee that she's postmenopausal. And that only works in women who are over the age of 50. You can't do that blood test on someone using combined hormonal contraception, because it will falsely change the result. So it's only done on women who are using progesterone-only methods of contraception, so the POP, progesterone-only pill. You can do it in women on depo. Not ideal, but really women using Depo-Provera should have been encouraged to change to a different method of contraception by 50 anyway.
So you're seeing your patient, you've made the diagnosis, and you're starting to think about HRT. Let's start with the very basics. Why do we sometimes need to give two different hormones?
The NICE guidance has got a really good flow chart, and the Primary Care Women's Health Forum, there's a really good guide on how to prescribe HRT. If anyone wants to go and have a look at those, they're also on the toolkit. But basically, as women, we want estrogen. That's what we want. We want our estrogen to replace, because that is the fundamental hormone that's changing at the time of the perimenopause. If you've had a hysterectomy, unless it's been for something like endometriosis, if you've had a hysterectomy, then you can use estrogen only, and you give as much or as little estrogen as that woman needs to improve her symptoms. And she can choose to have that estrogen by a patch, she can choose to have it by a tablet, she can choose to have it by a gel or a spray. So she gets the dose of estrogen that she needs. If, however, she's still got a uterus, or she could have any persisting endometrium, so say she's had a hysterectomy for endometriosis, they might not have got all those little bits of endometriosis around the peritoneal cavity, so there is a risk that there might still be some endometrium. And an endometrial ablation, where the lining of the uterus has been burnt off, in theory there may be some little bits of endometrium left. So wherever there could be endometrium, then you have to give a combined preparation which includes estrogen and progesterone. If you give estrogen on its own to those women, they are at risk of getting endometrial hyperplasia and endometrial cancer, which is why they must have the combination. The next challenge is to work out, do I need to give someone a bleeding preparation, so a monthly sequential combined preparation, or can I give them a continuous combined preparation? If a woman is still having periods, then she needs to have a cyclical bleed for at least a couple of years. If she is beyond that time, then you can give her a continuous combined preparation, so a no-bleed preparation. And you can't give that to a woman who's still having periods, because otherwise you might get totally erratic bleeding and then not know whether to worry about that or not. There are two other considerations. One would be if you're using the Mirena. Now, it does have to be the Mirena as an intrauterine system, because that's the only one that's licensed for HRT. But if they're using a Mirena, then you can add estrogen, and that's a brilliant combination because it works for HRT well, but also gives contraception that some women will need. And then the last case we need to think about, some women don't actually need to take systemic HRT, and they've just got main problem with vaginal symptoms, then you can just use vaginal estrogen. Just to help with that vaginal dryness.
Thank you. That's a really useful summary. Now, I'm finding that more and more often women are coming in, possibly after they've seen celebrities on the TV talking about the menopause, and they're asking for bioidentical HRT. Could you explain what that is and if it's something we should be using?
So bioidentical HRT is a thought that it might, the products used might be more natural. The problem is there is no proven benefit over standard HRT. They're not regulated in the same way. And the big concern is about whether or not there's enough progestogen in them or whether that has enough safety effect on the endometrium. So British Menopause Society have a very good consensus document on their website that talks about bioidentical HRT. And I think what we need to be saying is, you know, there isn't the evidence about use of it in the same way, and actually we should prescribe what we should prescribe, which is standard HRT generally.
That's really useful to know, particularly when they've come in after seeing a very persuasive TV programme the night before. So you're seeing a patient who clearly has menopausal symptoms and you think they would benefit from HRT, and you broach the subject. And I'm sure you've experienced the exact same thing that I have. The woman looks utterly horrified and says she can't possibly use HRT because it will give her breast cancer. How do you handle that situation?
The problem for us as clinicians is there's been lots of studies and there's very conflicting data about breast cancer risk. We see one study that says it's safer. We see another study that says it's really not safe at all. And it's hard to get our head round it. Basically, the older forms of HRT, where in combined HRT, so there's a estrogen and a progestogen, in those older fashioned, older forms, then there might be a slightly higher risk. If you take HRT for a couple of years, that risk is very small. If you take it for 5 years, that risk is very small. The risk is really about taking that product for over many, many years, when actually the risk does increase. There's some good infographics available. The British Menopause Society have got a great infographic. And what's really useful about that is not only does it portray the relevance of that risk, which is small, particularly for shorter timescales of using HRT, but it puts it into comparison with other lifestyle factors that we have, which are much more risky. So obesity is much more risky on the breasts than HRT. Alcohol, if we have 2 units or more a day, that's slightly higher risk than HRT, and not exercising is high risk for breast problems. So it's about putting it into perspective so that she can understand the choices available to her.
So let's go back a bit to HRT and contraception. So you've talked about needing to use contraception for a year after your last period or after a menopausal level blood test if you're over 50, and it's 2 years if you're under 50. But how can a woman who is not using the Mirena as part of her HRT, how can she get adequate contraception at the same time if she still needs it?
Yeah, it's a great question. And we give out hormones and women think we're giving out contraception. So we have to remember that HRT is not contraceptive. And on the other side, the contraceptives, progesterone-only contraceptives, do not give enough endometrial protection that we can give them alongside estrogen only. Obviously, combined hormonal contraception, if you are using that, and we should stop that about the age of 50, you know, that does work as an HRT. It gives the same benefits to the vasomotor symptoms. But generally, women are either using an implant or progesterone-only pill at this time. Now, if they are amenorrheic, so they're not having any bleeding while they're using that, then what they do is they continue with the implant or they continue with the progesterone-only pill, and you add in a continuous combined HRT to that. If they are having some irregular bleeding with the POP or the implant, then what you can do is give them a sequential combined HRT or a cyclical combined HRT, so you can regulate the bleeding a little bit more, but you have to use them both together.
So we all try to be holistic in our practice. As well as the discussion about the actual HRT, what other things might you talk about in a menopause consultation?
As ever, it's a personalised approach, it's individualised, the conversation. You know, it's what matters to her about what are the worst parts of her symptoms so that we can think about managing her holistically. But it's also a great time to think about lifestyle. So we're at the age of 50, we're often balancing this, that and the other. You know, we might not be putting enough time in for relaxation or exercise. Some women might be slightly increasing their alcohol intakes. They might be smoking. You know, so it gives us an opportunity to start thinking about how do you want to cope for the next 30, 40, 50 years when you're going to have more risks because you're going to have less estrogen. So it's a good time to reconsider risk management. Self-management, some women will say, well, actually, I don't want to take HRT, and they might go and talk to a pharmacist about products in buy over-the-counter, which are non-evidence-based, so we shouldn't really be encouraging them. Think about other things like joining a gym, relaxation, just other ways of helping themselves. So it's a great opportunity to just wrap a lot of care around a woman at that time.
That's really useful. And it's always important to think, isn't it, about the things other than just the medical. So I think we're probably coming to the end of the podcast now. What would you say are the key take-home messages that you think are the most important?
A menopause is a very difficult time for many women. I think we undervalue the impact of it on many, you know, women at workplace. Suddenly, if they're starting flushing and sweating, you know, how the psychological and stressful impact of that, on top of a time when they're often feeling tired, they're often feeling more anxious. So it's a time for us really to offer support. There needs to be better education of clinicians about managing HRT and trying to unwrap the evidence from some of those very complicated and conflicting studies so it's clear about how we can give the right information. And signpost women to good online resources. Menopause Matters is very good. Rock My Menopause is very good. So women can go away with the information that they need to make the choices they want about their care.
Thank you very much for joining us, Anne. I found that really useful. Thank you to everyone for listening to this RCGP podcast, and please do join us for the other three podcasts in the series. For more information and resources, please visit the Women's Health Hub, which is at rcgp.org.uk/women's-health. And thank you very much to Endometriosis UK for their support.